Welcome to The Talking Earth on KBOO Portland, community-sponsored radio. And we're always looking for community support. Over 80% of our cash comes from you, the listeners. There's no commercials. You can go to kboo.fm/give and see how you can donate. As usual, I have three fine local poets doing sets for you. And I'll throw in a couple poems along the way. So let's get right to it. First up, we have Michael McDowell. He's published two books of poetry, The 100-Year House and Gnarl Ridge, which you'll be reading from. From 2002 to 2022, with Bill Siverly, he co-edited Windfall, a journal of poetry of place. For 35 years, he taught literature, composition, and creative writing at Portland Community College, specializing in nature and landscape writing, American literature, and eco-composition. So now let's take a hike with Mike.
The poems I'll be reading are from my newest book, Gnarl Ridge, which is a collection of walking poems, urban walking and mountain hiking and backpacking, mostly set in the Cascades, especially on Mount Hood. The first poem pokes fun at ultralight hikers, who sometimes go to extremes to cut down the weight of their packs, which I do too, but not quite as thoroughly as some. Ultralight backpackers. They brag like six-year-olds. My base weight is lighter than yours. It's no longer just sawn-off toothbrush handles and margins cut off topo maps. Now it's a single titanium pot to boil water for a freeze-dried meal eaten from the bag with titanium spork. Still hungry? Drink some olive oil. Goodbye, white gas and Optimus cook stove with your brassy good looks and fiery roar. Denatured alcohol in a soda can bottom now quietly heats the water to hydrate the food. 5 squares of toilet paper a day. Who needs more? Flashlights stay home. Hands-free headlamps the size of horse chestnuts grow from foreheads to create all the necessary glow. Ditch the tent. A tarp's all you need. And the mosquitoes? Sleep with a head net on. Wear earplugs so you don't hear them. Camp on ridges, windward sides. The ultralights breeze past on the trail, swift as trail runners, as we plod onward, weighted with what's needed for the wind, rain, impalings, burns, and fractures my daughter and I might suffer. Instead of water bottles, they carry plastic bladders which curl into the size of a cigar with the weight of a butterfly. They flutter past into a carefree dream of eternal sunshine, warm breezes, and soft starlit nights. I always want to know the names of flowers, plants, and insects that I encounter outdoors, so I'm naturally a fan of cell phone apps like iNaturalist and Seek. This poem is entitled Seeking IDs Beneath the Trees. We wannabe botanists amble along Woods Creek, pointing magic wand phones at plants and trees so an app can tell us what we see. Of course we know what we see. We've known since childhood these dandelions, blackberries, and fringe cups. But wait, it's not dandelion, but nipplewort. Lapsina communis, a long, thin stem delivering nursing mothers a soothing balm. That's trailing blackberry with its stem like a string, ready to wrap incautious ankles or wrists. Berries so beloved by bears, it's Rubus ursinus. And now I've confused fringe cup with youth on age. Tolmia menziesii, daughter plants piggybacked on the older stem to present a vertical lineage. In the half shadows of the late spring woods, we traipse like truffle hunters with eyes on the ground till our seek and find app tells us what we've found. Many mountain hikes now involve moving through recently burned areas. These burnt forests conjure images we might never have connected to a forest. In this next poem, the acronym CMYK refers to the four colors of ink used in color printing: cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. The new burnt forest, Cascade Creek Burn, Mount Adams Wilderness. The burnt forest says monochrome. No more Kodachrome and CMYK. A new climate calls for a new look. Goodbye, hushed cathedral of trees, stained glass window, light shafts through the needles, quiet prayer of footfall on duff. Our fossil fuel ways change the forest look with fires that burn hotter, faster, farther, remaking forests in our own image. Bristly green mountain hemlocks and firs once waved green boughs frothy with needles. They now stand in smooth black flared gowns. Their thin black clad arms point sun-silvered fingers at each passerby. Here and there, trees in déshabille, their blackened bark loose and falling off, cluster in conversation groups. They say to us, "Here's your new forest, liposuctioned, belly tucked, snags and stumps on a forest floor of ash." For miles of burnt landscape, we can see Mount Adams' summit through the vertical black snags as through the bars of a jail cell in which we have put ourselves. In the next poem, terpenes are substances that trees give off that create the smell of a forest. Coniferous trees send out especially strong terpene smells. This is a poem in response to a conversation I once had with a student who puzzled over what anyone would do in the woods if they didn't fish or hunt. What do the woods do to you? You don't hunt? You don't fish? You don't ATV? What do you do when you go into the woods? An 18-year-old student. Better to ask, once in the woods, what happens to you? What do the woods do to you? Terpenes of hemlock, noble fir, cedar on a hot day send smells that lift your head off your shoulders. Heady wind across a hillside of sage inebriates as surely as a cloud of poppy smoke. The trail at every step threatens to trip with rocks and roots, rubble and mud slicks, fallen branches, twigs and sticks to make you pay attention to the tread. Woods shower you with a show of power, the snapped trunks of thick trees, a gust of wind as you round a rock face, the push-off balance of a glacial melt stream. Certain terrain raises hairs along neck and arms. Cross a scree of vision quest pits crusted with lichens and algae, and you feel the presence of flowing energies. Woods shake you free of everyday comfort. Rocks inner shoes, cold shivers your spine, branches scratch arms, burrs attached to socks, sunscreen sweat stings eyes. Evidence of death forces contemplation. Ghostly trunks of dead white bark pine, the rib cage of deer, scattered feathers and beak of bird, an owl's vomit of fur, bones, and teeth of a mouse. Stand still. A varied thrush sounds a single note. A strand of spider silk undulates in the breeze. A creek burbles. The woods empty your mind of everything but this wild world. I am especially grateful to all the volunteers who built and maintained the trails we hike on and restored degraded natural areas. This is Restoration, Woods Memorial Natural Area. On a July afternoon, so hot the rhododendron leaves curl and our tomato plants and dahlias droop, I take the puppy over the hill to walk cool, shaded trails along ravines of firs and cedars, maples and alders. Nessie sniffs right and left, stops to interrogate a clump of sword fern, paw a fallen cone, chew a branch of Nootka rose, snuffle a carpet of buttercups. We can hear I-5 over a ridge exhaling its continual sigh. In the heat of the day hush, a single bird calls then quiets. Beneath the green canopy, behind a wall of salmonberry, Woods Creek quietly gurgles over its rocks. Long ago, I brought my children here when a slimy creek slid around old tires and bumped against chunks of concrete and crumbled bank, which clogged its raw orange clay throat. We dodged clawing arms of blackberry, climbed over roots of upended trees, skirted seeps and sodden trail, and leaped the creek. English ivy smothered trees and slopes. After 20 years of activism, grants, and volunteers, now thimbleberry, Oregon grape, and foam flower cloak the slopes. Salmonberry and Indian plum hold the stream's banks and cool its riffling waters. The puppy pauses on a crib wall high above the creek, then bounds along a boardwalk, peers through cedar fence rails. We stop on each footbridge for the damp air of creek bottom to wash over us, welcome as an ocean breeze. Two reasons that I go hiking in the mountains are to encounter potentially dangerous challenges, like figuring out how to cross a thundering whitewater creek, and to encounter other hikers who are often more knowledgeable and skillful than I am. This is Crossing Newton Creek, Gnarl Ridge, Mount Hood. I sat on a boulder pulling off boots, wool socks, nylon liners, watching snowmelt water batter a jumble of logs and branches laid between boulders in the current. I turned at a clatter of trekking poles. "Do you have a plan for getting across?" A gray-haired, tank-topped woman shouted over the roar of water. She listened to me, then yelled to three others, "There are logs across here." Before I'd removed my second boot, she was on the jumble of thin logs, placing a boot here, her poles there, stopping, calculating, continuing till, dry-shod, she leapt to gravel shallows on the other side. Three other gray-haired women followed, similarly slow, sure-footed, testing each step, smiles creasing their faces, like the Chinese figures placidly crossing the bridge on a blue willow plate. I velcroed on my stream-fording sandals, tossed my tied-together boots over my shoulder, and stepped my wobbly legs into the pool above the logs as the women watched. Left foot ankle deep, then right foot up to ankle, calf, knee, thigh, and still no bottom. I backed up and moved closer to the logs, legs brushing branch stobs underwater. I waited, and the women waited, standing in a row and smiling as I stepped onto the bank, dripping, water roaring a thunderous applause for us all. A number of people, such as Robert Michael Pyle and Richard Louv, have lamented the loss of hand-me-down habitats or throwaway landscapes, forgotten, degraded, and abandoned vacant lots, gravel pits, and banks of ditches, places where children can experience nature hands-on. This childhood poem addresses the issue. whacking brackens, Pteridium aquilinum. They grew as tall as our 8-year-old bodies, filling the small clearing bordered by maple saplings. For Townie and me, they became pirates, cattle rustlers, bank robbers, grizzly bears. We strode among the bracken ferns, arms swinging, our stick swords singing. Whack, whack, their spindly spines crumpled, and fronds flew right and left. They always returned the next year, more numerous and glorious and tall. More attacks, more whacks, more dead, demoted from understory to ground cover. Hillside woods between our houses gave us a world to lop, carve, sculpt, reconfigure. Trees to climb, trails to run, dirt to dig, bugs to collect, seasonal creek to dam. Lucky the kid able to whittle a childhood from nearby woods of decaying logs, scrappy weeds, rocky slopes, vacant lots, ditches, left alone landscapes.
Thanks, Michael. I'm going to throw in a poem by Elisa Gonzalez. Hope I'm saying that first name right. The book's called Grand Tour, and this is The Night Before I Leave Home. My brother gets out of bed at 3, having lain down only a few hours before, and pulls on his jeans and stubs his toe on the door jamb and cuts himself just a scratch, reaching too fast in the dark for wallet and keys. And the weapon? A bill, probably. He goes out under the huge sky, out of the small house and beyond, fields upon fields, where as children we played hide-and-seek and tag, and all those games. I miss them. All we imagined. In my brother's mind, the fuzziness of the awakened too soon after not enough sleep, and the resentful calm that comes when doing your duty to those you love, to whom you could not do otherwise. He drives too fast, as always, braking hard when he finally arrives at the meadow my car slid into before it slid into an oak, where a whitetail hangs, strung by its hind legs to drain the slit throat. It takes more time than I expected for death to be over. I tell my brother, and he, a hunter, says, "Yeah," in that tone that means, "Of course." And years later, I have the same voice when he calls at 4:17 a.m., and I knock the phone off his bed, answering almost upside down, stretched toward him. His pain, then, I lived for it, I realize now, not for its existence, but to quiet with my words. I had left so long ago. I had left. The doe's eyeshine keeps us company. We joke about our dead new friend. We share a fifth of Jim Beam tugged from under the passenger seat. By the time the tow truck rumbles up, it's well into dawn. We are giddy, like children who have played a game so holy they have forgotten the rules of the real world and naturally don't want to remember. My brother turns to me near sunrise to ask, "What do you think he's doing right now?" And I spin a story of a father waking to polish his teeth, spit blood into the eye of a porcelain bowl, wash a face like my brother's. That was a game, yes, us seeking the man he was when not hurting us one and then the other. And then the game ended, as children's games do, when authority says it's time to disperse, when the other gets on a plane and one is left. Elisa Gonzalez. And from Elisa to Zaji, Zaji Cox, who was the winner in poetry in PDX's reading series and has participated in several events, including the Portland Book Festival and New Voices of Color. Her work can be found in Pathos, Cultural Daily, Year of the Asterisk, and others. Her memoir, Plums for Months, was published last May by Forest Avenue Press. And here's Zaji Cox.
I'll share some poetry that I've written and published in the past, and then I will move on to some of my newer work that I've published last year in my memoir. And this poem is called Defamiliarize. What will you do with the rainstorm I've put in you? When a desert has become a forest, how possible is it to adapt? You were the river that guided me to the waterfall I didn't know was there. You were the smooth rainbows of oil come to slide across my ocean's surface. And when the sun had parched my skin, you came as the downpour that created a flood. In the dunes, I never could seek you out, though the desert always suited you best. In the forest we created together, the foliage pressed too far apart for me to see between. Every grain of sand's impossibility to remove one by one, to reveal a shining silver treasure of a core, fit you just right. The old chair with its creak, the song of the chimes above the door pushed by a jasmine-scented breeze, so known by now it's become us. Does it become unfamiliar? And will you stay reeling from what you've done, the will to expand shrinking with the ability? What will you do with my rainstorm? What will you do? And then I can read another one of my poems that I published a while ago. That one was from 2019, and then I read that at a couple of different places. Okay, and these were some of my first poems that I ever published. And this one is called Cleanse. I burned sage to clear the air of her, but she lingered, stuck around my cluttered and dark room, sucked at the available air until there was hardly any left to breathe. I kept waiting for her to come back, to come up from behind and press her fingers onto my face, to dig her nails into my eyes and stick flecks of silver polish on my chin. I shower in cold water, but still feel her scratch down my back, leaving raw, red marks on my skin. And this next one is The Followers. Hedonistic heathens will drink the night, will taste 10,000 daisies in a rose-colored city. They will stumble in shadowed groups under stringed lights with mouths wide open, drinking, grinning, falling into each other's arms, and sway by the road on their way to the forest. The heathens follow none but their pleasures. In the trees, they grasp at each other's palms, reaching, wanting, and taking. Wolves dash at the sound of their hoots and gasps for air in the dark. And they do not settle but collapse in a confused tangle, a shared embrace like twining ivy, a firmness that nature itself would envy. Good memories from high school.
Wow.
And I can share some pieces from my memoir next. Not poetry, but some essays. And this is called A New Almost Home. The fir and cedar trees over Palmblad Road are towers under which a mother and two daughters drive to the house whose weight is rooted into the ground. Gravel shuffles under car tires and the doors click and creak open to a world of cool, moist air. The trio emerges to marvel under a gray sky so unlike the clear, hot desert air they left behind. The home, owned by the mother's father, stands waiting. Through the months that flow into years, the mother and daughters make a home of the weathered 110-year-old house that shelters mice and spiders among the 2 acres of property that are not theirs. Over time, objects accumulate in rooms to make the house feel like it belongs to the three. College textbooks, family pictures, and framed artwork brought by the mother lean on downstairs shelves. In the mother's bedroom, picture books for the younger daughter lie on one side of the bed, and long text-heavy books for the mother lie on the other. The older daughter's room holds incense, CDs, magazine photos, and historical fiction novels. The younger daughter's room is decorated with toys and a rainbow of clothing in the nook of a closet. Books soon start to pile on one another. Her wolf bird transformer toy eventually finds its spot in the plastic toy container under the bed. Its legs don't fold in the way they should, but she sort of likes that this makes it unlike any other. As the rain of autumn becomes the rain of winter, the mother and older daughter keep the house warm with chopped firewood and the downstairs heater that sometimes works. Summer finally arrives to bring enough blackberries, blueberries, grapes, apples, and plums for months. Hands scrape past thorns and reach above tall branches to pick the very best fruits to cook with. The younger daughter helps cut back the invasion of blackberry bushes around the sides of the house, whose vines tap the windows. Her small hands curl around hedge clippers and reach as close to the roots as possible. With nimble fingers, she helps mend the broken downstairs window with plastic and tape. Some nights, the three listen to the wind howl, the house creak, or the rain and wet tree branches thrum against the house, and continue to adjust to the new nature. They huddle closer in the living room, closer to their popcorn and movie and each other, and let the outside music play in the background. This book was written to, like, kind of in honor of the old 110-year-old house that I grew up in with my mom and my sister. And there were a lot of feral animals that lived around it. A lot of feral cats and lots of maybe coyotes or feral dogs. We weren't super sure. But we always heard them in the background yipping and howling. And there was kind of a sense of wonder that I had growing up around that house. And the house is no longer standing, unfortunately. But the reason I wrote this book is just to kind of immortalize the house in words, in a way. And my mom and my sister and I, we had our little trio of, wonder, so to speak. We just kind of had our own little, like, rituals of, you know, making cookies during Christmas time and going to the Nutcracker, or, like, picking all of the fruits during, you know, late summer, and just, like, you know, cooking together in the kitchen, and, you know, my sister and me playing outside on the trampoline and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I just wanted to make sure I got all of those memories in my book. And one of the pieces is about our encounter with some feral cats. It's called Congregation, and it is true, I promise. My confirmation of a fairy tale life comes the day we interrupt a black cat meeting. The mundanity of a return trip from the grocery store dissolves in the midst of this mystical feline presence. They sit like little ink spots at the end of our gravel driveway as the three of us roll up in the car, and we fall into a hush as if under a spell. Some latecomers are strolling in, and they all face each other, calm and pacing, all swiveling heads and flicking tails. There are at least 10. I have never seen so many cats in one place before. This land, the property owned not by us, but our mom's dad, with this 110-year-old house, the land that we have made into our home, suddenly feels like it belongs to another, someone not human. Our mom slows the car. We three watch from afar, trying desperately to preserve this moment. Time vanishes. The black cats could be talking about anything, sinewy in their motions and slow blinking as they look at one another. Subtle yet confident. My mom and sister whisper from the front of the car while my reverence multiplies. I find that I'm holding my breath, worried about the inevitable grand moment when one sees us and alerts the others. A shock, a jump, an urgent scatter. I will my mother and sister not to make a noise. And yet, slowly, they begin to disperse, one by one, as if planned. I slowly let out my breath and my muscles relax. Don't go. They almost seem reluctant to leave. I imagine them planning their next meeting. Our only evidence is our word. I think I was a kid when that happened, and my sister was in her teens, I think. And we remember it differently. My sister says that she was actually up in the window or up in the house watching from the window, and it was actually my mom and me in the car. I just remember the three of us, like, just seeing it all at the same time. And so my brain remembers it as us all in the car. But either way, we all saw it. We all remember it happening. So it definitely happened. I also grew up in a very athletic household. My sister was a competitive gymnast, and so that kind of guided me into the world of competitive gymnastics. I started when I was about 7, and I started with a few classes a week, and then eventually I started going to meets as well. And one of my best events was the uneven bars. And so, yeah, I thought I would kind of write about that. Exactly. This one is called Competition. Grips placed just right. Holes around index and ring fingers and dowel situated near the palm. Velcro wrapped around the wristbands just tight enough, but not too tight. Get your chalk from the pile in the container and rub your hands together for just the right amount. Stand ready. Your teammates and sister coach are watching from the sides, eager. They can rely on you for a good bar score. Watch the judge. You don't need to be reminded not to fidget. Being the uneven bars, it's one of the rare times you don't. Watch for his hand to lift and for him to say your name correctly and a good luck wish. Raise your arms to present and step up to the mat. Face the bars. Bend the knees and swing the arms to get a fluid motion as you jump to the low bar and begin the routine ingrained in your body. Engage the lats, traps, dorsi, abs for the kip. Let the momentum rotate you around the bar. Feel it rest against your hip, then cast to raise your body above and then to stand on the bar. Jump to high bar. Engage the biceps and deltoids to bring yourself up. Glide in a smooth rhythm while you circle your body around again. This one, it's one of your best executions. There is a hush. The area around you, including the crowd of parents, has gone quiet. You feel dozens of eyes on you, which has never happened before. The judges, out of the corner of your vision, are scribbling furiously while they keep their gaze trained on you, but don't get distracted. And as you feel the dozens of eyes on you and swing on high bar, preparing to release from the routine you're somehow executing so well, the familiar routine that today feels so unfamiliar, notice the astounded hush inside you matching that of the crowd that may have uncovered a different you, hidden. After the slap of your feet on the blue mat when you dismount, always so over so quickly, under a minute, there is something like a breath before your team applauds. And the crowd, like an audience, they keep clapping after you raise your arms to the judges again in the finishing salute and then go to sit down. Your score is a 9.825, the closest to a 10 you've ever gotten. Your shoulders, which you didn't even realize had been tense, relax. This different, unhidden you basks in the congratulating, the pleasure of pleasing your sister, and the sense of security in your teammates. She wants to go hiding again, but that's okay, because you know where she lives and will find her again. We moved from New Mexico to Gresham, Oregon, when I was about 3-4 years old. And I remember very specific details. My brain is very detail-oriented, and I think that's part of my neurodivergence. And my dad's family, my dad's side of the family, they were all still there. And eventually he would come move up here just to be closer to me. But going over to my dad's house, once he did move over here, he had a bunch of pictures and things from New Mexico. And so when I would go to visit him, I would reminisce about our life back in New Mexico. And so this piece is called Old Photo. I hold the edges of the little rectangle gingerly, sliding it out of the frame that rests on my dresser at Daddy's house. Here in Portland, Zaji's room is white, with toys in their shining gold chest. Books are lined up neatly, though there aren't as many of them, and Archie comics hide in the sliding door closet. The bigger window shows not a wild forest yard, but a cul-de-sac with straight white houses like this one. A neat and paved nature trail cuts through the grass and trees off to the side. Instead of classic rock, I hear smooth jazz floating up the stairs. I'm careful not to smudge the shiny side of the photo. 3-year-old me remains pristine, a perfect blur in pink and white suspended from the monkey bars. I lift the picture to my face and smell the print of ink on paper. Each color has its own scent. The bitterness of the corner shadow made by a finger covering the lens. The almost sweet pink ink of the pants over my straightened legs. My eyes are drawn toward the steady grip on the bars, the knees and feet pressed together, the little frown of concentration. The world in the photo is tan and brown, with sides of adobe buildings and flat desert land. I can hear the quiet of New Mexico desert, my first home. It's not like the quiet of the green, which speaks of birds and dampness, soft patches of moss nestled between towers of trees. The desert's quiet is a flat and open, all-encompassing dryness, wind hushing between dry brush and tumbleweeds. No forest shades the background. What green there is stands tall and brave under the relentless sun. I think of Daddy's side of the family there, sunny and smiling.
Thank you, Zaji. Whether you're listening to this show on radio, computer, or some other device, it comes from KBOO-FM, a community-owned radio station, community-sponsored radio station, for over 55 years. And a big chunk of that community power comes from your donation. Only about 10% of KBOO's listeners are donors, and it's easy to be one. Any amount is appreciated. You can go to kboo.fm/give. You can fax 44321 to KBOO, or is it the other way around? And, you'll figure it out. You're better at this stuff than I am. I'm just sweating in front of a microphone. But, before our third poet of the day, let me throw in a couple poems by Maggie Smith. Someone had referred me to this particular poem, or the title poem of the book, Good Bones. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I am trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. Story of the Mountain. Home is not what the woman had imagined. Late fall, the fields are cropped to stubble, the mountain already rust and smoke. The trees must have flamed here, but she's too late. The man has threaded himself through the trees on their best black horse, and a hawk has dropped its shadow on the child and won't lift it away. The girl is learning to read the world, and every turned page reveals something peculiar, wholly new. In the story of the mountain, the trees burn for as long as they can bear it. The horizon blurs and wobbles like a heat mirage. The woman doesn't know how the story ends. Like the mountain, it has a shape, but she's too close to see it whole. The poet Maggie Smith, not the actor. And whoosh, we're on to the final featured poet tonight, Brittany Corrigan. Brittany is the author of the poetry collections Daughters, Breaking, Navigation, 40 Weeks, and most recently, Solastalgia, a collection of poems about climate change, extinction, and the Anthropocene age, Anthropocene, you know, stuff people caused. Brittany is an alumna and employee of Reed College. She is currently working on her first short story collection. For more information, visit http://BrittanyCorrigan.com. And here's Brittany speaking for herself.
Hi, this is Brittany Corrigan, and I'm going to read to you today from my new collection, Solastalgia, which is from Jackleg Press, just came out this past July. And it's all poems that deal with issues of climate change, extinction, and the Anthropocene age. And the word Solastalgia means, people ask me this when I'm reading, the word solastalgia means like a nostalgia, like a homesickness for the home that you're already in. And it's come to mean sort of this, like an, you know, like an existential crisis around climate change and the state of our planet and this home that we're living in. So I'm going to read a handful of poems from Solastalgia and then a few new poems as well. So this first poem is called Canis, and this is one of what I call my unloved animal poems. Not unloved by me, but unloved by others, and hopefully I can change your mind. So this is Canis. You think you want the puffball pooch for your lap, or the gentle giant that lets toddlers pull its ears, or the hound trained to bring back limp birds in its mouth, refusing instinct, whistle-whipped, gorged on praise. But the slender beast that roams your streets at dawn and dusk has walked this ground a million years. When wolves and jackals land-bridged their way out, coyote stayed, survived the poisons, bullets fired from planes. Misunderstood, coyote knows your nature. Slides between cars, its muzzle full of mice. Come now, doesn't your heart wish to trot down darkened sidewalks, outwit what has clobbered it, yip and howl at every streetlight moon? Here, come stand at the window. Watch the yellow eyes, ears that swivel toward the city's hum. This is the dog you've always wanted. The one that turns city to wildscape, stops you in your tracks, unguards your door. And I'm going to follow that with another one of the unloved animal poems. This is Possum Nocturne. Perhaps it is poor night vision that keeps us from seeing how you preen our streets, devouring what the sunlit crows have left behind. We misunderstand your mouth, crowded with keen-edged teeth that dissect and undo the flesh we are too squeamish, too unbrave to carry with our human hands. We should envy your thanatotic form, how death visits you, but then retreats. Why do we not adore your prehensile tail, how you dangle and brace and grip like the acrobats we embellish with sequins and tulle. The darkness inside your pouch, the nyctophilic eyes ripening within, should allure us like the night sky we wish watched over our city noise, the one so thick with stars we're less blind for its light. Okay. Next up, you can't see this on the page, but this is a big, long, chunky prose poem, and it's called Carpe Diem. Forget the day. How hours flatten the way rising water turns islands back to sea, how minutes tire of treading and flail their tentacled fingers above the surface, grasping at gull legs the mired rim of a trash vortex, anything to hold on to before seconds turn blue from the effort and the whole mess siphons down. Yes, forget the day. In terms of this planet, a planet that has been here 4.5 billion years, our existence but a fraction of a percent. event, a blip even to the dinosaurs that tromped and scrabbled themselves across the Earth's crust 159 million years longer than we've been digging our toes in the sand, swinging from branches, praising the soil, stewarding the land, or unrocking the mountains, or replacing redwoods with skyscrapers, or talking about the weather, or generally effing everything up. Yes, this isn't about the day anymore. It's about reach out and grab that ice shelf. Don't let that big white bear and her two black-eyed cubs float away. Carpe Ursus Maritimus, Carpe Pongo Abelai, orangutans grooming their 97% identical to human genome selves in the rainforests. Please, Carpe the rainforests. Carpe Panthera pardus orientalis, Carpe Panthera tigris sundiaca. Big cats in their patterned fur coats, in their slink vanishing away from us. Carpe Balaenoptera musculus, whale shark, circling our dreams, vesseling its way through our paintings and poems. Carpe Thaumatibus gigantean, giant ibis, the world's most endangered and evolutionarily distinct bird. Carpe Atalasca anops, kawaii cave wolf spider that doesn't spin webs, that chases down its prey the way we are chasing our own tails now, digging ourselves a meteor-sized crater of a grave, exponentially expanding daily what we'll take down with us, dragging the aurora borealis and its tundra and permafrost after us. Yes, forget the day. Carpe, the last of the dark sky places, the quietest places on Earth. The deserts with their nocturnal rhythms, flora and fauna that know what it is to survive. Yes, forget the day. Carpe noctis, carpe noctis. Let there be stars when we seize the last of the light. All right, a big breath after that one. Throughout this collection, there's a series of what I call the Anthropocene blessings, and they're poems that were written for a variety of endangered species, both animal and plant. So this is my favorite one of those blessings, and this is Anthropocene Blessing, California Condor. King of birds, you of the 9-foot wingspan, you who glide for hours on currents of air without a single beat, thousands of feet above the leaden earth. Scavenger ancestor, only surviving member of your genus, longest lived. May you feast on the flesh of the dead as you toss their spirits up to the sky. May the carrion ghosts look down upon your unplumaged head, your black-feathered sacred form, and be healed of all that stalked them in this world. May you be not poisoned by our buckshot, seething in each carcass we leave behind. May you outgrow our captivity to hatch your single eggs in mountain cliff caves, giant redwood trees. New world vulture, may your bulbous, wrinkled visage remember how you soared over mammoths. May you be revered as virtuous, as rising back from the brink, as gathering your flock around the fallen. May you take death in your mouth and find it sweet, find that it sustains. I'm going to read you two more little ones from this and then a couple of new poems. So, there's also a series of triolets, which is one of my, I don't write in form very much, but this is one of the forms I really like. I like ones that repeat themselves. There's a series of little triolets about sort of the parallel ghost lives that walk beside me, things that I didn't pursue. So for many years, I thought I was going to be a marine biologist before switching my major to English. So this is triolet for the marine biologist I didn't become. My land limbs twined and woven in the deep, with bodies flippered, tentacled, and finned. Remora-like, my heart's barnacled keep. My land limbs twined and woven in the deep, among the upright whales plumbed in their sleep. Beside the walrus seamed and thickly skinned. my land limbs twined and woven in the deep, geared body flippered, tentacled, and finned. The last poem I'm going to read you from the collection appears towards the end, and it's actually one I usually like to end my readings on because there's a lot of darkness in the poems in this collection, and I think it's important that we sit with that darkness, but I like to leave us with a little bit of hope as well. So this poem is called Miraculous. When all the news is bad or worse, my ears ringing like a din of night insects, just swelter and drone. I quiet my bones with the thought of quaking aspen. Trembling giant, grove of thousands of trees, all with a single system of roots. A million years old, bright fluttering of gold against blue. And when I think I can't take in another sorrow, each a stone stacked up like a cairn on my heart. I remember how the jaws of a snake unhinge. Its mouth opens and opens to enfold what's impossibly large, patient swallowing followed by a length of rest. And when what we've done can't be undone, hope just a speck on the future's woolly back, I jumpstart my wonder with this. The snow in Antarctica is sprinkled with the dust of ancient stars. While we hunted and gathered, the galaxy glittered and lay itself down in our light. So, I'm gonna read you just a couple of new poems. So, that I don't think I've read out before, so this is exciting. So from some new projects, I have an interest in road ecology and wildlife crossings and the interaction of animals with roads. So this is from that project. It's a poem called Extirpation, which is a word that means a local extinction. And there's a little epigraph at the beginning to inform what it's about, which is that it isn't just the number that are killed by cars, but the inability to cross large, busy roads that are putting the mountain lion at risk. Populations are hemmed in by highways, leading to inbreeding, which could cause the species to disappear within 15 years. That was from Euronews. So this is Extirpation. The road is not a surgeon, not a scalpel excising flesh from flesh. The mountain lion is not a hatchback, not a semi barreling toward the escape. The road is not a wall, though it might as well be. The big cats tumble their cells, braid their double helixes like to like. The road is a guillotine. No, the road is an electric fence, an electric vein of lights and grills and steel. The shoulders of the mountain lion ripple with each silent step. Her eyes are not headlamps. Her cubs are not a gas gauge hovering over E. The road is a drain. The road is a knife. The road is a closed-eyed hum. The mountain lion is a yellow-eyed window. Her body is one part mammal, one part guardrail. The road is a scalpel. The lion licks the edge, laps the fog line as the road purrs into the night. And then one of my other current interests is I've been writing a bunch of poems about NASA missions that just sort of started happening. So this one is Artemis. And Artemis is the NASA's mission to send the first woman to the moon. So yeah, and those of you with a keen ear will hear the sort of the repetitive form that's happening in this one. Artemis. We can build a ladder to anything. Sing, goddess, of how our rungs tongue at the edge of Earth's night. Bright sphere we worship and leash, greasing our rockets for the trip. We slip into lunar suits, stare, knock airlocks open into the cratered dust. Crust of oxygen, silicon, magnesium, calcium, iron, aluminum. Minerals, feral on the far side in the starry dark. Mark this hunt with a footprint, a flag. Drag the skin of the surface back, rack of antlers for our home planet's mantle. Satellite skull of the moon, strewn with debris we left behind, we find you wildless, unanimaled, called by tidal force. The first woman, human heart slowed in outer space, places her foot on volcanic ground, no sound like a deer in the wood. And I'm going to end with something brand new for you. So I got interested recently in the duplex form that Jericho Brown invented, in which it's a series of couplets, and the first or the second line of each couplet becomes the first line of the next, and then it wraps around to the beginning. It's kind of a broken sonnet. So this is Duplex with Winchester Mystery House, which is another one of my longtime obsessions, even though I've never visited yet. Duplex with Winchester Mystery House. Heart on fire, arms empty, I dream of stairways to nowhere, doors that open onto walls. Now, here, two doors open onto walls. Twin ghosts of the past and the unknown. Ghosts twine from the past to the unknown, and I can't help but keep building more wings. I can't help but keep building. More wings, more turrets, more rooms for my restless heart. Make room for my restless heart, a turret shell hiding a soft body within. No amends ply my soft body. No marriage ends without a haunting. The architecture of two lives arcs toward the texture of one life haunted. I dream of stairways, arms empty, heart on fire.
Thank you, Brittany. Thanks to all three of our future poets tonight, Michael McDowell, Zaji Cox, and Brittany Corrigan. Go hear them live or buy their books or just indulge in any poet, preferably local, to hear or read them. Thanks to all those bookstores, bars, and other establishments that have literary readings. Thanks to the local bookstores that carry small press poetry. Thanks to the Talking Earth's founders, Walt Curtis and Barbara Lamorticella. Thanks to the host of Second Monday Talking Earth, Patrick Bocard, who keeps this program going. Thanks to all of you who are listening right now or any time or have listened in the past. A little poem I saw in my window, I call it Pendulum Pug. Runs as far ahead as the leash allows, then explores until the leash pulls him forward. Repeat. I have a view here. I don't have to own a dog or clean up its stuff, waste a lot of plastic bags. But hey, what does dogs have to do with poetry? Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the dog runs freely through the street and sees reality. Yeah, and a dog sees something that looks just like him. We're all dogs, God spelled backwards. Praise to poetry and the English language. Thanks again for being here. Bye.